Hi, everyone, and welcome to My Damn Services. My Damn Services is a full-service production and consulting company that helps utilize artificial intelligence to develop and manage synthetic media for you and your business. My name is Frank DiCarlo, and Henrik and I are welcoming two guests today, which I'll introduce in a moment. This is our second webinar within this synthetic media webinar series, where today we'll be delving a little more into advertising and marketing. If you missed our first one, you can, of course, find that on YouTube and our different social media platforms. Please check it out. We spoke to Alex Serdug. He and his team, Emmy Award winners, are doing incredible things with synthetic voice. Not only are they restoring people's ability to speak who have speech disabilities, those robotic voice boxes, those days are gone, and they're replacing those voice, but they're also doing incredible things with artificial intelligence and voice cloning. So truly remarkable. But today we're very excited to have both Timur Kardam, creative director and technologist at Magic, and Oliver Feldwick, head of innovations at And Partnership. Thank you both for making time today. On today's webinar, the four of us are going to talk about just some of the many advantages of synthetic media in marketing and advertising, and why it is an excellent way to generate material. We'll begin by looking at how it is being used to produce convincing and highly realistic images, videos, and audio files that seem and sound real, and how businesses are benefiting from the ability to hit target markets and create precise marketing and advertising materials quickly and inexpensively. And we're anxious to obviously get started. But before we do that, I want to mention that Henrik Deger, the co-founder of My Damn Services, you just finished and published a brand new book, Synthetic Media, The Next Reality. If I may, in the book, Henrik, you do an incredible job sharing the conversations and experiences of how companies are struggling with content creation, and how they're now producing content at much larger scales while retaining audience attention through everything synthetic media has to offer. So I just wanted to take a moment and congratulate you. Great job. As a reminder, and in this series, we will be inviting others to speak on relevant topics and the latest AI advancements that bring beneficial synthetic media strategies. It's our intention to explore how much of artificial intelligence is positively influencing synthetic media, and at the same time, accelerating much of the creative processes with more possibilities and scale. So with that said, I think it's time to get into it. Henrik, do you want to kick it off? Start asking our incredible guests some questions today.
Yes, thanks, Frank. So again, my name is Henrik Deger, and I appreciate all of you joining us today for a conversation around marketing and advertising with synthetic media. So let's kick it off with Timur and Oliver. First question is around the ethical and organizational point of view. How could synthetic media be used correctly versus badly in the advertising perspective? Timur?
Well, I guess we've all seen the bad, right? So I'm not sure we need to talk about that in extensive detail. Like the non-consensual stuff, deepfakes, we've all seen it. I'm mainly concerned about the positive impacts that we can use, right? And there's really a lot of positive stuff that can happen, and people are sort of hesitant because as soon as the word deepfake, you put it in your mouth, and clients are hesitant, right? Because they don't want to be connected to that to that word in itself, even though in its essence it just opens, a breath of opportunities. And you mentioned the voice cloning. That's a great example, like the Val Kilmer case, where he lost his voice and he gains it back. Another great case was the Bruce Willis, case where he ended his career, but just coincidentally, licensed his likeness to a Russian ad campaign, which basically means he can then extend his career to infinity and beyond, right? So these are obviously great cases. And I personally, I'm really excited about this whole topic of what I call a hyper individualized content, right? So now, as we can create cheap content at scale, we can take data of persons and can address them personally, right? We can call them out by name and really cater the content to their liking. So I think that's tremendously exciting. The opportunities are just vast there.
Oliver?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think what's interesting is, as with lots of other new technologies, it's essentially, it's a tool. And, you know, that tool can be used well, it can be used badly, and can be used ethically, and can be used unethically. And so I think, you know, what's exciting is about, you know, what we can potentially do with that tool. And, you know, I mean, as Timur said, you know, there's a lot about some of the intentional bad that can be done, like the intentional sort of unethical stuff. I think there is a watch out around like the unintentionally unethical stuff and the unintentionally mediocre. So I think, you know, we're developing a new tool that I think can, you know, I think we face this current content dilemma where we need to put more content in more places. We've got the ability to serve up content, but we haven't got the capability to create content for all of those different scenarios. This could solve that. The risk would be being that, you know, we use it to just create mediocrity at scale. And so I think, you know, I think we can recreate some of the existing problems. You know, advertising isn't perfect now. If we just use synthetic media to turbocharge, you know, mediocrity or lack of diversity or lack of creativity, I think that's a risk that, you know, beyond the jazzy headlines around deepfakes, I think is the other risk of, you know, the cost of creating content is generally a bad thing, but it does at least make you think about it and it makes you value it a bit more. If we can create content at essentially a zero cost, there's nothing stopping us making, you know, 10x or 100x as many bad ads and then targeting people with it. So for me, I think that's the watch out, is we're creating a tool that can do great stuff. We should also be intentional about what we then do with that tool and make sure we realize its potential.
Great points.
Cool. So it's also the democratization aspect, I guess, that's touched there, right? So it's sort of everyone can do art now. Is it art necessarily then? Well, everyone's the judge for that, I guess. Yeah, valid point.
Let's dive into the next question. What can we do about integrating synthetic media into existing workflows and processes?
Oliver, I want to go ahead. Or
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting one because, you know, as to follow the tool analogy, you know, as we integrate new tools into the process, you know, there's going to be quite a process of sort of education and upskilling to be like, okay, what can we actually do with this tool and what can we do well with it? And I think for me, the interesting angle is going, the obvious immediate benefits is to do things cheaper, faster, or more at scale. But above and beyond that, I think there's also an opportunity to do things that would otherwise be impossible to do them to you know, create, you know, push the bounds of creativity as well. And I think to really realize that, I think, you know, understanding how they work and how to get the most out of them is going to be, you know, a key part of it. There are lots and lots, you know, and I come at this from you know, an agency background and kind of mindset of just quite sort of boring logistical and sort of organizational challenges that are going to kind of creep up of just, you know, there's one thing, you know, how do you charge for this? And I think, you know, a billing model is difficult. You know, there's no incentive to switch over if you're an agency that works on an, you know, hourly rate of a designer to do something and you go, well, we swapped it over to a magic tech tool. And so, you know, the cost to us has gone down, but how can we still build that onto clients, and should we? And I think, you know, then there's some existential and logistical questions for agencies of going, how do we put this into practice? And then similarly, I think there's a little bit of, you know, we are used to a certain level of control and knowing how and when the handoff between, you know, synthetically generated assets and then being manually edited versus synthetic editing. You know, I think sort of text to image and text to editing is all really fascinating. Then when you come around with round two of going, that's pretty good, but actually I want it to be slightly different. Are we then going to be building tools on top of tools that will let us do synthetic editing of synthetic images? These I think are all interesting things that haven't really quite been looked at. You know, I think I think we're at the interesting experimental stage where they haven't been shaped into being, you know, tools that do quite specific narrow tasks like advertising. Not that there's anything inherently difficult or magical about it, but I think it's just a slightly different set of requirements that I think hasn't been considered as much upfront.
No, that's a great point. And I think we've seen it before, right? Especially with artificial intelligence. Henrik and I have seen it in the digital asset management world, where all of a sudden there was AI tagging, you know, meta tagging. And you heard the industry just say, oh, well, we don't need human beings anymore to do any more tagging for images, which couldn't be farther from the truth. There's still going to be the human element, you know, and same with this text to images, right? People are going to be going in there. They're going to talk about maybe making an image of their daughter, right, on the cliffs of and the computer's not going to understand who her daughter was. Or in the creative world, maybe asking for their marketing director to be in a boardroom, for example. So there's still going to be that element of needing ourselves to be involved in. As you were saying, Oliver, to have these tools upon tools, we have to be keeping a perspective as to how these tools can work effectively for ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, we're just at the very beginning, you know, of this being, you know, even commercially viable. So it's basically just out of the lab, and we're looking at this, you know, obviously with different goggles, right? We wanted to do this, you know, and I mean, the AI scientists are like, you know, amazed. Everyone is amazed what it can do, and everyone's just blown away. And then obviously the requirements from each of the different markets come in, and everyone has like, why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? Right. And this is also, we can see, like, for example, voices, I think they're a great case because they are so highly controllable. Right. I mean, obviously maybe there's still the issue of not being able to, for example, put emotions in certain areas or really direct it super granularly, but there's new AI now, you know, altered AI has that, where you speak in and it sort of like takes your cadence and you know, applies it. So this is already sort of like the second step now. It's a great example of, so there's AI now in the raw sense, and now there's like creative saying we need this feature, right? And then altered came in and said, okay, now we're offering voice cloning, but with this with the feature set that is applicable for commercial applications, right? And I think it's the same is true for, you know, generative AI. Like I think for a client to say, you know, if you offer a Coke to say we create a can of Coke, yeah, sure thing, like Oliver said, right? But then you probably have to go in manually until Coke is satisfied, because there won't be this semi-random output. While it looks gorgeous, is not specifically what they asked for. So the control level, it's just not given right now in the specifically text to image level. And this is why I'm a bit advocate of saying, let's use these real-time engines, you know, feed the frame buffer of Unreal, for example, into that stuff, and then use Clip or Diffuse or whatever to then get the, you know, these extra 10%, like the perfect 10% to get to 100. This is actually where this stuff gets really sexy, you know, and this is where it helps a lot. And this is what we did, where, you know, we deepfaked CG characters. Right, because to get CG characters, you know, meta humans or not, to the 100%, almost impossible, right? But then if you just tell the AI, you know, this is the composition, this is the lighting, this is the motion that I want, now make it perfect, right? And this is a great case where we use different tools to sort of like hack into the AI and sort of like nudge it towards a direction, because you need to be able to direct it. You know, you're the conductor, and without these controls, you sort of like, it's just random art, right? Which can have its appeal, but it was a very hard sell when I was, you know, talking to a creative agency 6 months ago, and the only thing that I could show was like these really artsy generative artworks, you know, that were amazing in itself, but like obviously, like to make that transfer onto a commercial project, it was basically impossible. Everyone was trying, right? Maybe we can have a landscape, maybe we can have, you know, where, you know, and I'm you know, this, I'm trying to coin this term where we don't design to budget anymore. Right now we're designing to technical limitation, right? We're suggesting stuff that works really well, but please don't suggest stuff to clients that are just hypothetically possible in a lab, but it would just, you know, it would backfire so badly.
And it's easy to underestimate like cultural and skills relearning. It just reminded me of, I remember when social and stories was a new thing, like the idea of the idea of changing the frame from 16:9 to 9:16, and you'd have people with 25 years of film experience and directors who are like, everything I know works in landscape, and you know, my cameras aren't designed to turn. And you go like, it's, I think we've not even got to the start of finding out what are those weird little, like the weird little challenges around implementing synthetic media into a very established workflow that, you know, could do with updating and evolving. But like, there's a lot of little, like, you know, all of those little things that, you know, you wouldn't have predicted, and they're not complicated technical challenges. It's a relearning challenge.
Yeah, and that's a great point. So transition into my next question around, what are the logistic challenges in making synthetic media happen today? Granted, a lot of these technologies exist today, like text to video, text to image, speech to speech that we talked about last time. All these tools, right, and editing all these potential outputs to the last 10%, so it's not mediocre to Oliver's point, but it's actually, it is scalable, right, to infinity, and it is almost limited by our own imagination now, right? Because we can't imagine it, we can't type in what we want or edit what we want. But there's less limits, but we're making the rules as we go along, right? With based on the technical limitations that we have, back to Seymour's point, right? So what are those other logistic challenges that we're facing?
Well, I guess, I mean, one big challenge that I face in Germany quite often is both the GDPR and / infrastructure topics, you know, like, because a lot of these experiences require some sort of, you know, backbone infrastructure. And because the German clients, even the global players, but the German branch are like very hesitant to sort of say, yeah, sure, spin up 250 Unreal instances, and then we feed in personal data of people to then spin up, like, it's a big topic, because the requirements of these sort of like services at scale, they haven't been there before, or very rarely, and they're sort of like hesitant to go that to install it once, you know, even though I try to convince them, once you have a CG character that you could just, you know, type in text and it just spins up, you know, thousands of Unreal instances, and we render a clip per recipient, right, per user, we can generate that at scale at literally no cost. Still, they're hesitant to do that step, but I think we're almost there, and once that's ready, and we're working hard on a framework that does specifically that, so you can create content, hopefully not mediocre, but high quality stuff, and then provide that as a service, so that we don't have to always talk about this sort of like infrastructure and the data topics, you know, time and again, because it's a bit of a grind there, I have to say.
And is it a limitation on just doing a pilot and proving that proof of concept, or is it the spend, the total spend for n number of instances?
It's both, or? Right? Obviously, the initial cost is sort of like, they're sort of hesitant to do that, even though the benefits, you know, much outweigh the disadvantages, but like, and then the data, like obviously GDPR, you know, like if we're as an external entity need the data, you know, because we're setting up a thing called sequential storytelling, where we sort of like hook up a CRM, right, and then we can basically trigger certain video generation, right, hyper individualized per client, right, but the initial costs are there, and then obviously they need to feed that data to us. There's just no way around it, and to make sure that there's no, you know, that we don't do bad stuff with that data, you know, it's we need to prove it, and you know, pen testing and all the you know, they're very sort of hesitant, and I can relate, right? I get it, but the opportunities are still tremendous, so we're pushing forward in that area a lot.
I think there's a tipping point when at what point the benefits, be that creative, cost, whatever, will outweigh the short term setup costs, the risk and the uncertainty. You know, we have a tried and tested manual approach that works, you know, 99% of the time. So there needs to be quite a good sort of I think from a tech point of view, you go, wow, wouldn't it be really exciting to do it this way? And I think there's a, you know, and there is, and it could be slightly more exciting or slightly more personalizable. And I think that benefit needs to, and you know, needs to be, the case needs to be made that there is enough of an upside and enough of a benefit that you got to push through the initial, you know, the initial challenge to get there, which I think, you know, a big part of it for me is choosing narrower, well-defined use cases and nailing it. You know, I think it's why you see, you know, AI generated email subject lines. You know, it's a creative opportunity that no one minds. You know, if an AI copy bot tells you this will work and then it works, you haven't got stubborn creatives saying this, you know, that defending their right to write email subject lines. And so it's a much easier argument to have. Whereas, you know, I think same with, you know, the whole artificial general intelligence, you know, trying to do an artificial general advertising model is much harder than trying to pick off little bits and solve those parts of the puzzle with a solution that's kind of definitive, rather than sort of have something that does a lot of creative stuff, but is quite an unwieldy beast to use, which I think is why we're getting to the really exciting, you know, I think the sort of the video production at scale is the big prize, but it's the hard one to fix.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I mean with, you know, combining it with the virtual production world, really, where we use all the stuff that's already sort of established, even though not for everyone, right? I mean, I'm still doing heaps of talks and try to educate about the benefits of virtual production. And then looking in the eyes of the recipient, and then I see, can I now open up, you know, another, you know, Pandora's box, and that is synthetic media, and like, and what the benefits would be if we marry the two, because they match in heaven. But like, sometimes I see, okay, they have troubles just grasping the implications of virtual production, right? Using game engines to create content at scale, and be it fully CGI or a mixture with green screen, or even like the LED volume, you know, Mandalorian style, like that stuff. And then if you tell them, well, the whole campaign shouldn't be, the output shouldn't be a TVC like it back in the day, right? This isn't the big prize anymore. The big prize is really this unique clip that people can have, that basically has you and Dwayne The Rock Johnson drifting in a Ford Mustang, and Dwayne is pointing at you and saying, what an awesome dude, right? I mean, just hypothetically, that's sort of like you say, right? The big prize. And I would say we're not that far off from this stuff. It's really because the virtual production stuff, Unreal Engine mostly, but you know, Unity as well, I mean, they're almost there. And like I said, then using this synthetic stuff to just do little bit of tweaks, you know, not just generate, like not asking the AI to generate a world for you. It's not going to happen. Not yet, at least. But just combining it in a smart way and creating a case that just blows people's mind. And I think this year is the year to pull that off.
We were talking about that prior, as far as the advancements in just the short amount of time and what's been happening, and people, the adoption of it. And you're describing conversations that you're having with creatives that are just getting around to understanding what a little bit of what the synthetic media and production can offer them today. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm, like I said, I mean, I'm talking C-level, you know, chief creative officer, you know, you show them this, and then, yeah, what is it good for, right? And then you're like, you're really almost shocked by, you know, by not the inability to do the transfer. And then you're trying to do that for them, even though ideally, obviously, we're the tech people, right? Ideally, we team up with the creatives to then bring that, you know, storytelling to the next level, right? Really create a, not mediocre, but really a compelling piece that really touches you. And it touches you because there's stuff that you couldn't have done before, right? Because you had to address the entire market, right? Almost. And now you can really go down and address them by name, or, you know, make it localized by zip code. All these things are possible now, and at a low price. I mean, it's really amazing, especially the cloud compute is a very important topic here, right? Like in this context, people are, you know, real-time rendering on a single machine, yeah, fine. But like if you're able to scale this stuff, then it gets really interesting, but you need to be able to control it. And the danger there, obviously, if you fuck it up 100,000 times, well, then it hurts, right? So we have to step up the game slowly.
Yeah, and there'll be mistakes, as we all know, that'll happen. And but I think it's a value judgment of like, where is that person's time worth the talent that you have on the said team, whether it's a copywriter, is there a copywriter's time worth creating a subject line for an email versus an AI doing it, right? Or doing copywriting on the first drafts. Here's some drafts to consider and then tweak that rather than reinventing the wheel, right? And granted, it's stepping on toes to a degree, right? On some people's toes in the creative space, because technical can not replace, but augment, right? And it's like a technical with person, not technical only or just person, right? And so it's marrying the both and having that sweet spot. But my next question is similar to this, is around, is the creative landscape ready for this change? Is it the mindset there? Or what needs to happen to educate the creatives and clients alike to have this happen? I mean, we talked about scale. We talked about the implications of privacy concerns, like CRMs and things like that, and GDPR. But it doesn't seem like they're seeing enough examples, right? Is that what's missing? The examples that to prove, to show the creative, because the creative, if I speak about something that might be possible today, it's one thing. But if I can show them examples that you just showed me, described and visually showed me, I might be able to understand better. Is speak to that if you can, Timur and Oliver.
Yeah, Oliver maybe from the inside of an agency.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of a firstly. I mean, it's like the classic customer journey of like, you know, there's awareness, understanding, consideration, and then, you know, conversion, becoming a user. But no, I do think like that sort of general awareness and familiarity is the first stage. And I think we're sort of getting there on that of going, you know, it exists, people sort of understand it. Then I think there's a bit of that kind of credibility. Like I think I often find like the analogy that I find sort of helpful is the origins of like 3D animation and the birth of Pixar. And in those early days, traditional hand-drawn animators thought the idea that you could create an emotional story using 3D graphics was heresy, and you know, we're either furious or just in denial. And I think you see a similar element at the moment, when particularly when you get to AI generated sort of creative concepts or emotive art. You know, I sort of think, again, no one's going to fight you if an AI has done your taxes or generated an email subject line. But if something moves you and you listen to a piece of music that moves you, or you watch a piece of film that you think is beautiful, and then someone afterwards reveals that it's, you know, it's generative art and no humans really had a hand in it, people feel, I think there's quite a sort of visceral, you know, existential kind of like affront that I think is the cultural shift that people need to get there. But I mean, like with 3D animation, 3D animation started out kind of as a toy. You know, it was first used in gaming. It was Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer video. It was like the first mainstream use of like that new technique. And, you know, that ultimately led to Toy Story and then, you know, the world we're in now, where no one would deny that, you know, this is an incredibly valuable and worthwhile, you know, art form. And I think we're in a similar place with the broader world of synthetic media. So I think that kind of credibility and understanding gap is the bit where we're sort of at the moment. And I think, you know, it's a bit of learning and developing on both sides as well. You know, I think the tools are still evolving and figuring out where to fit. And I think the creative world and, you know, advertising world, both logistically and kind of culturally and, you know, philosophically, need to figure out where it fits into their discipline and into their world.
Did you want to share some examples with the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I could share, you know, so because for me, I think, you know, what's kind of helpful is, you know, both in the sort of virtual production space and in the sort of synthetic media or sort of generative art space, I do find, and again, sharing sort of internally with my organization, the thing that really helps is just something that shows what's possible. And I think that helps people kind of fill in the gaps. So, you know, I mean, we talked about, you know, DALL-E 2 and, you know, the idea that, you know, you've got so many different variations that you know, again, and I think it's the idea of, you know, and the Imogen from Google today, I think evolves this even further. But just looking at this, you get an immediate sense of artwork that is being created that is pretty compelling and pretty convincing from this sort of text to image world, which I just think is you know, is a really sort of compelling, you know, compelling thing to see. It just needs a bit of spelling out that it's not just a toy. Like, with just a few tweaks, this could be a really, you know, a really useful and usable thing for like ideation and inspiration, but also for actually generating assets and generating and assets. And then maybe I might just play a minute or so of this, which I just think is really helpful because it shows, it sort of shows that blend of real and virtual production in a way where, you know, in the long run, it becomes impossible to sort of differentiate between them. It's sort of a false distinction almost. So if I just play, I'll play this and put it full screen for a minute.
Thomas Anderson in the Matrix trilogy. Those films pioneered digital cinema with shots like bullet time. Back then, we talked a lot about where the digital age might take cinema and narrative. In an industry where actors have tried to remain perpetually young, we wondered about digital faces that could become immortal.
Hi, I'm Carrie Ann Moss, and I played Trinity in the Matrix films. 20 years ago, we asked ourselves how long it would be before faces and bodies could be changed as easily as we change clothes.
We wondered, what would identity mean in a completely digital world?
And what would reality mean? When a world we can build feels as real as our own.
Oh, what just happened?
Yeah, this is what they wanted. They said they were fine with your theoretical mumbo jumbo, but they needed some sexy action.
Who said?
The Mark.
So I think, you know, so this was done as a little demo to sort of show, you know, get the hype up for the new Matrix film, whatever you thought of that, kind of irrelevant. But I think this is a great demo of, as well, you know, it's predominantly sort of Unreal Engine production and a mixture of sort of meta-human, like avatar production. But also I think there's, you know, there's bits of sort of deepfake type technology where you really can't tell where, you know, the actors end and the virtual characters begin, or, you know, you can, but it's quite hard to tell. And you just go, for me, that, you know, something like that to a, you know, creative team helps to bring to life, you know, some of the opportunity and the excitement of going, okay, that becomes a bit tangible there. Obviously there you've got, you know, blockbuster talent and blockbuster budgets and that helps. But similarly, with those, you know, they're doing the impossible with that production already. And that, you know, on a similar but smaller scale, you know, I think in all creative endeavors and within Adland, you know, I think the opportunity has got to be there, not about doing the same but on lower budgets, but on going, actually, let's do the impossible in more and more of our content in a way that's really compelling and breathtaking.
Timur, did you want to share something too?
Yeah. I'm maybe just on the Matrix case. It's funny how the former visual effects supervisor is now the CTO, like from the Matrix, is now the CTO of Epic Games, right? Where you can see visual effects people crossing over. And another anecdote in this context is that Unity just bought the digital entity of Weta Digital, right, for $1.6 billion. So you could see how everything is interlinked there, like the post-production visual effects world and the game world, this you know, back and forth happening all the time. And it's sort of like also finally sort of my story, you know, coming from a film, like a feature film visual effects classical background, and then we transitioned into, you know, first Unity and then Unreal, used that for interactive projects, and funnily enough ended up creating films again in the Unreal Engine, even though that wasn't, you know, initially intended. And now all of a sudden we're back sort of like at the same spot, still a camera rig on your shoulder sort of filming, but now it's all in virtual land, right? But it's really cool to be able to use the tools, you know, and helping, you know, even these traditional filmmakers basically putting this camera rig on their shoulders and be like, they're like, what am I supposed to do with this, right? But there's no camera on there. And like, well, you don't need a camera, you just need a screen. And you, and we put them in the Unreal Engine, and then they're filming like they always did, right? And they do what they do best, right? And then they do lighting, and they do all the stuff that they've done in the past, but without the boundaries, right? This guy's like, so can I make this an Alexa 65 now with, you know, the most expensive camera right now, more or less? And, you know, can I have any lens? And yes, and then, but then finally, if he paddles back and be like, no, let's stick to reality. Like, you know, use a lens that is grounded in reality. And then we can use all the, you know, we can combine the best of both worlds. And it's, and in this context, I want to share a couple of screens, maybe just semi-random. But this is a quote that I love to show every now and then. You know, Roger Deakins is obviously not a nerd, you know, like he's not one of those geeky guys, you know, we'd be like, he loves just CGI, right? I mean, he shot Big Lebowski, right? He would be the last one to say, you know, we should do everything on the computer. He just observes what's happening. And when he says Hollywood films, then, you know, for us, that just means, for me, that's just content, you know, moving content. So obviously, and that's very true. You know, like I think in the next 10, latest 20 years, that will happen. And if you look at the Avengers movies, right? And then the behind the scenes, it's just a couple of guys in front of green screen. The only thing real is the humans and a bit of the ground. The rest is all CGI anyway. So now once we cross that chasm where we can have the humans photoreal, obviously production cost, you know, much, much lower, more flexibility, all these things, right? So that's obviously quite relevant in this context. So a couple of things. So maybe just, I mean, sort of my message underneath here, right? The core message is really, you don't need a product anymore, right? It's obviously always pushing it to the max a bit, like the core message, it doesn't have to be, but this is obviously a thing that we did 2 years ago, you know, shooting a car without a car, right? So that's, and you can obviously, then you can modify this virtual camera with a smartphone. We even, you know, added scratches and fingerprints, the stuff that you always happen on car shoots. You don't want it, but it happens, and you need to add that to get that extra realism, right? And then I have this example, funnily enough, Unity. By the way, Unity bought another company called Ziva Dynamics, like the muscle simulation guys, also very tied to Weta and all the big visual effects companies. And then they spit it out. You probably saw that, you know, the no actor needed. Don't, you know, take it with a grain of salt. It just, you know, to get the message across. But if you show that to someone with no CGI background whatsoever, I would argue the majority would have a very hard time telling that this human is not just completely synthetic and CGI, but real time. Like, and the implications of being able to have a human like that, maybe eventually interacting with you with 60 frames per second and making eye contact and doing, maybe you know, we're NVIDIA Inception members, right? So they're ramping up their CGI avatar unit, and obviously what they have is obviously also the Asian gender detection. So obviously that woman could potentially react to you, right? React to the individual and the age and the gender and the context. So that's obviously extremely exciting. Not just the ability to create even more linear content at scale, which is also very appealing, right? But the interactive component. And then obviously this example from a guy, I think in Japan, where I just grabbed it from Twitter. There's heaps of examples, obviously, for virtual locations, but I love this one because it's a single guy creating a photoreal, you know, train station in Japan. And the ability to just throw that onto an LED wall, potentially, or say do a green screen shoot, you know, and have that tracked in real time and in sync with the talent, and then push of a button, we're on Mars, right? I mean, that's sort of the promise of virtual production, right? So those are the three core elements of virtual production. And then obviously this voice cloning here, this is a, you know, the Corridor Crew, I don't know if you know the guys, amazing people, worth following their YouTube account, but they're checking out the Altered.ai. And Altered.ai is really this, what I mentioned before, the ability to really transfer or like really perform and then have that performance being carried through into the clone voice, right? I just play that through, hope the audio comes through nicely.
The idea of being able to take your voice
and AI mouse control of it is pretty crazy, because right now I can sound like a wizard
rather than sounding like just
so this is also a good example of, you know, like I said before, like where someone really answered the need from the market. And very similarly, these GPT-3, for example, right? When we have large language models, and you mentioned the copy of an email, and now there's obviously then startups coming in the space that answering the call and create a sub like product and just, you know, copy AI, which really just says, okay, we're just offering you what you need there using this stuff, right? So I'll just skip through. By the way, maybe on the data topic, I'd love to show this meme here from Hart Woolery, where, you know, the data topic, obviously, you know, where obviously same with Imogen from Google, they need to train it on some data. So obviously that's a topic. Well, I think we don't have time to discuss that today, but like I was just have some cherry picked examples here from DALL-E that I just loved from the web. And I think this is also interesting where as humans needing to learn prompt design, like as in sort of like an art form email, even like what is the AI liking the best? And a great example is this one, my favorite image. And if you look at the prompt, you really need some experience. You really need not just experience, but you also need to have knowledge about, you know, the actual skill of photography, funnily enough, right? Because you need to know what backlit means and macro and studio light and so on and so forth. So and here, this is a great example because it shows we're almost there, right? This is production level photography level. I mean, resolution limitations being one thing, we don't know what the commercial application of DALL-E will be capable of doing. And another great example, I just love that one. And by the way, on touching on what Oliver said about the ability to modify that output, I mean, DALL-E has that example. So for example, I always give this example where if you want him to have a mohawk, you can do in painting, you know, you load this image back into DALL-E, you paint on his head and just say, make him a mohawk, and he will reflect the style, right? It will look like a Lego mohawk. So that's we're almost there. And I think in the next iteration you will be able to just iterate via voice. So that's I think quite exciting. And yeah, the last one, I mean, it came out today, right, Imogen? So Google has sort of like answered the call. So this is their DALL-E contestant. So yeah, very, very exciting times. And maybe just quickly in a test that we did 1.5 years ago, where please don't look too carefully at the CG character, but what we did, it's just an R&D test where we trained a model with an influencer girl. We borrowed her liking, sorry. It's not a commercial product. I want to stress the fact we just did this for R&D cases. And then what we did was really just using a traditional virtual production case, right? Where, you know, we have this, you know, environment, any environment, and we have this girl, you know, being played with a mocap suit, right? And now obviously she looks extremely CG, but then we say, please AI, try to find a face. It finds it, and then we sort of apply deepfake. And this is what I, you know, refer to as synthetic production, where we take the best of both worlds, really, and marry them in a way that, you know, it's not quite out of the uncanny valley yet, but this is also a non-paid, you know, R&D project. I think we could push this a lot further. Just as an example of this, you know, the combination of the two. And the last one, not from us, but by Intel, and it's basically the same approach. I'll just play that back quickly.
To understand what that means, let us have a look at some footage from the game Grand Theft Auto V. The game looks great, but it is not quite photorealistic. Let us now turn on our method. Our method modifies the images from the game to look more realistic. It is a convolutional network which produces images frame by frame and can be run at interactive rates. This model was trained to translate GTA 5 to the Cityscapes dataset.
Again, on the data topic, very interesting.
Cityscapes contains mostly images of German cities recorded with an automotive-grade camera. Here are a few examples from the dataset. With a model of reality induced by Cityscapes, Our method paves the roads with smoother asphalt, increases the glossiness of car paint, and greens the sun-dried hills of GTA's California. The results are geometrically and semantically consistent with the input images and temporally stable.
That'll be it. I think just, you know, a brief overview of what we consider synthetic production. And obviously we're at the very beginning, but like you could see the potential is just limitless, really. It's just our imagination and the education of specifically, obviously, the agencies, because we sort of rely on these agencies to come up with these cases and to understand, like, even at the very early stage, right, at the creative stage, because what I always, sometimes they come to us and want some, you know, magic techno dust, right? And that's just not the way this stuff works, right? You need to conceptualize the entire campaign about the possibilities of this technology, and then you can create really next level stuff.
Awesome.
Sorry for the long monologue.
It's obvious that we could sit here for most of the day and talk about all the possibilities and everything that's becoming available. And then we touched upon the rate in which it's changing and advancing is just it's just amazing. But I want to respect everybody's time. Oliver, is there anything that you wanted to wrap up with before we?
As you say, that, you know, the possibilities are what's really exciting right now. And I think, you know, the rate of technology is really impressive, but then also I think what we can do with it. And I think we're going to see more and more smart applications of it coming up over the next, you know, the next 6 months, next year or two, because I think it's really reached that point where creatives are increasingly embracing this and making use of it. And when it reaches a certain point, I think others will follow. So I think exciting times ahead, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. I think the company's success is going to be based on their embracing synthetic media.
I sometimes give this example of the cab driver. You know, I tell this cab driver excitingly about this company called Uber, and he's like, "What do you mean? Does that affect me in one way?" Like, it's really sometimes, you know, when you're in this creative realm, you really want to embrace this stuff. And, you know, like Oliver said before, like, there's so much opportunity, but some people really just rather, you know, duck and cover and try to let it pass. It's just not going to happen. You know, it's changing everything. And like I read on Twitter, this guy like saying, "Who would have thought that, you know, illustrators are among the first to be made redundant by an AI?" Like, I wouldn't have, you know, bet it on that one. Mm. Sort of as evil as it sounds, even though it's not true.
Some people are still wrestle with change, for sure.
Certainly in Germany, I can assure you that.
I think it's beyond Germany.
More, Oliver, thank you so much for making time today. It was an incredible conversation. And
pleasure.
Maybe we'll be doing more of it, because there's other topics we'll be touching on, and I'd love to hear your insights and your what you have to offer it. Yeah. So until next time, thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
Same to you.
See you next time around.
Lovely. Thanks again. Thank you guys.